wrong, but I had no way to tell her. So I pushed at her thigh with my muzzle. I nosed in and buried my face between her legs, and I waited there, afraid.
"I feel like someone's crushing my skull," she said.
I couldn't respond. I had no words. There was nothing I could do.
"Someone's crushing my skull," she repeated.
And quickly, she gathered some things while I watched. She shoved Zoe's clothes in a bag, and some of her own, and toothbrushes, all so fast. And she roused Zoe, and stuffed her little kid feet into her little kid sneakers, and bang, the door slammed shut, and snick, snick, the deadbolt was thrown, and they were gone. And I wasn't gone. I was there. I was still there. 10. Ideally, a driver is a master of all that is around him, Denny says. Ideally, a driver controls the car so completely that he corrects a spin before it happens. He anticipates all possibilities. But we don't live in an ideal world. In our world, surprises sometimes happen. Mistakes happen. Incidents with other drivers happen. And a driver must react. When a driver reacts, Denny says, it's important to remember that a car is only as good as its tires. If the tires lose traction, nothing else matters. Horsepower, torque, braking, all is moot when a skid is initiated. Until speed is scrubbed by good old-fashioned friction and the tires regain traction, the driver is at the mercy of momentum. And momentum is a powerful force of nature. It is important for the driver to understand this idea and override his natural inclinations. When the rear of a car steps out, the driver may panic and lift his foot off the accelerator. If he does, he will throw the weight of the car toward the front wheels. The rear end will snap around, and the car will spin. A good driver will try to catch the spin by turning wheels in the direction the car is moving. He may succeed. However, at a critical point, the skid has completed its mission, which was to scrub speed from a car going too fast. Suddenly, the tires find grip, and the driver has traction. Unfortunately for him, with his front wheels turned sharply in the wrong direction. This induces a counterspin, as there is no balance to the car whatsoever. Thus, the spin in one direction, when overcorrected, becomes a spin in the other direction, and the secondary spin is much faster and more dangerous. If, however, at the very first moment his tires begin to break free, our driver had been experienced enough to resist his instinctive reaction to lift, he might have been able to apply his knowledge of vehicle behavior and, instead, increase the pressure on the accelerator, and at the same time ease out on the steering wheel ever so slightly. The increase in acceleration would have pushed his rear tires onto the track and settled his car. Relaxing the steering would have lessened the lateral G-forces at work. The spin would therefore have been corrected, but our driver would then have to deal with the secondary problem his correction has created. By increasing the radius of the turn, he has put himself at risk of running off the track. Alas, our driver is not where he had hoped to be, yet he is still in control of his car. He is still able to act in a positive manner. He can still create an ending to his story in which he completes the race without incident. And perhaps, if his manifesting is good, he will win. When I was locked in the house suddenly and firmly, I did not panic. I did not overcorrect or freeze. I quickly and carefully took stock of the situation and understood these things. Eve was ill, and the illness was possibly affecting her judgment, and she likely would not return for me. Denny would be home on the third day, after two nights. I am a dog, and I know how to fast. It's a part of the genetic background for which I have such contempt. When God gave men big brains, he took away the pads on their feet and made them susceptible to salmonella. When he denied dogs the use of thumbs, he gave them the ability to survive without food for extended periods. While a thumb, one thumb, would have been very helpful at that time, allowing me to turn a stupid doorknob and escape, the second best tool, and the one at my disposal, was my ability to go without nourishment. For 3 days, I took care to ration the toilet water. I wandered around the house, sniffing at the crack beneath the pantry door and fantasizing about a big bowl of my kibble, scooping up the occasional errant dust-covered Cheerio Zoe had dropped in a corner somewhere. And I urinated and defecated on the mat by the back door next to the laundry machines. I did not panic. During the second night, approximately 40 hours into my solitude, I think I began to hallucinate. Licking at the legs of Zoe's high chair where I had discovered some remnants of yogurt spilled long ago, I inadvertently sparked my stomach's digestive juices to life with an unpleasant groan, and I heard a sound coming from her bedroom. When I investigated, I saw something terrible and frightening. One of her stuffed animal toys was moving about on its own. It was the zebra. The stuffed zebra that had been sent to her by her paternal grandparents, who may have been stuffed animals themselves, for all that we saw them in Seattle. I never cared for that zebra, as it was something of my rival for Zoe's affection. Frankly, I was surprised to see it in the house, since it was one of Zoe's favorites, and she carted it around at length and even slept with it, wearing little grooves in its coat just below the animal's velveteen head. I found it hard to believe Eve hadn't grabbed it when she threw together their bag. But I guess she was so freaked out or in such pain that she overlooked the zebra. The now-living zebra said nothing to me at all, but when it saw me, it began a dance, a twisting, jerky ballet which culminated with the zebra repeatedly thrusting its gelded groin into the face of an innocent Barbie doll. That made me quite angry, and I growled at the molester zebra. But it simply smiled and continued its assault, this time picking on a stuffed frog which it mounted from behind and rode bareback, its hoof in the air like a bronco rider, yelling out, "Yeehaw! Yeehaw!" I stalked the bastard as it abused and humiliated each of Zoe's toys with great malice. Finally, I could take no more, and I moved in, teeth bared for attack, to end the brutal burlesque once and for all. But before I could get the demented zebra in my fangs, it stopped dancing and stood on its hind legs before me. Then it reached down with its forelegs and tore at the seam that ran down its belly. Its own seam! It ripped the seam open until it was able to reach in and tear out its own stuffing. It continued dismantling itself, seam by seam, handful by handful, until it expelled whatever demon's blood had brought it to life and was nothing more than a pile of fabric and stuffing that undulated on the floor, beating like a heart ripped from a chest, slowly, slower, and then nothing. Traumatized, I left Zoe's room, hoping that what I had seen was in my mind, a vision driven by the lack of glucose in my blood, but knowing, somehow, that it wasn't a vision. It was true. Something terrible had happened. The following afternoon, Denny returned. I heard the taxi pull up, and I watched him unload his bags and walk them up to the back door. I didn't want to seem too excited to see him, and yet, at the same time, I was concerned about what I had done to the doormat, so I gave a couple of small barks to alert him. Through the window, I could see the look of surprise on his face. He took out his keys and opened the door, and I tried to block him, but he came in too quickly, and the mat made a squishy sound. He looked down and gingerly hopped into the room. "What the hell? What are you doing here?" He glanced around the kitchen. Nothing was out of place. Nothing was amiss, except me. "Eve?" he called out. But Eve wasn't there. I didn't know where she was, but she wasn't with me. "Are they home?" he asked me. I didn't answer. He picked up the phone and dialed. "Are Eve and Zoe still at your house?" he asked without saying hello. "Can I speak to Eve?" After a moment, he said, "Enzo is here." He said, "I'm trying to wrap my head around it myself. You left him here?" He said, "This is insane. How could you not remember that your dog is in the house?" He said, "He's been here the whole time?" He said very angrily, "Shit!" And then he hung up the phone and shouted in frustration, a big, long shout that was very loud. He looked at me after that and said, "I am so pissed off." He walked through the house quickly. I didn't follow him. I waited by the back door. A minute later, he returned. "This is the only place you used?" he asked, pointing to the mat. "Good boy, Enzo. Good work." He got a garbage bag out of the pantry and scooped the sopping mat into it, tied it closed, and put it on the back porch. He mopped up the area near the door. "You must be starving." He filled my water bowl and gave me some kibble, which I ate too quickly and didn't enjoy, but at least it filled the empty space in my stomach. In silence, fuming, he watched me eat. And very soon, Eve and Zoe arrived on the back porch. Denny threw open the door.
"Unbelievable," he said bitterly. "You are unbelievable."
"I was sick," Eve said, stepping into the house with Zoe hiding behind her.
"I wasn't thinking. He could have died."
"He didn't die."
"He could have died," Denny said. "I've never heard anything so stupid, careless, totally unaware." "I was sick," Eve snapped at him. "I wasn't thinking."
"You don't think. People die. Dogs die."
"I can't do this anymore,"
she cried, standing there shaking like a thin tree on a windy day. Zoe scurried around her and disappeared into the house.
"You always go away, and I have to take care of Zoe and Enzo all by myself, and I can't do it. It's too much. I can barely take care of myself."
"You should have called Mike or taken him to a kennel or something. Don't try to kill him."
"I didn't try to kill him," she whispered.
I heard weeping and looked over. Zoe stood in the door to the hallway, crying. Eve pushed past Denny and went to Zoe, kneeling before her.
"Oh, baby, we're sorry we're fighting. Well, stop. Please don't cry."
"My animals," Zoe whimpered.
"What happened to your animals?"
Eve led Zoe by the hand down the hall. Denny followed them. I stayed where I was. I wasn't going near that room where the dancing sex freak zebra had been. I didn't want to see it. Suddenly, I heard thundering footsteps. I cowered by the back door as Denny hurtled through the kitchen toward me. He was puffed up and angry, and his eyes locked on me and his jaw clenched tight.
"You stupid dog," he growled,
and he grabbed the back of my neck, taking a huge fistful of my fur and jerking. I went limp, afraid. He'd never treated me like this before. He dragged me through the kitchen and down the hall into Zoe's room, where she sat, stunned on the floor in the middle of a huge mess. Her dolls, her animals, all torn to shreds, eviscerated, a complete disaster. Total carnage. I could only assume that the evil demon zebra had reassembled itself and destroyed the other animals after I had left. I should have eliminated the zebra when I had my chance. I should have eaten it, even if it had killed me. Denny was so angry that his anger filled up the entire room, the entire house. Nothing was as large as Denny's anger. He reared up and roared, and with his great hand he struck me on the side of the head. I toppled over with a yelp, hunkering as close to the ground as possible.
"Bad dog!"
he bellowed, and he raised his hand to hit me again.
"Denny, no!"
Eve cried. She rushed to me and covered me with her own body. She protected me. Denny stopped. He wouldn't hit her, no matter what. Just as he wouldn't hit me. He hadn't hit me. I know, even though I could feel the pain of the blow. He had hit the demon, the evil zebra, the dark creature that came into the house and possessed the stuffed animal. Denny believed the evil demon was in me, but it wasn't. I saw it. The demon had possessed the zebra and left me at the bloody scene with no voice to defend myself. I had been framed.
"We'll get new animals, baby," Eve said to Zoe. "We'll go to the store tomorrow."
As gently as I could, I slunk toward Zoe, the sad little girl on the floor, surrounded by the rubble of her fantasy world, her chin tucked into her chest, tears on her cheeks. I felt her pain, because I knew her fantasy world intimately, as she allowed me to see the truth of it, and often included me in it. Through our role-playing, silly games with significant telltales, I saw what she thought about who she really was, her place in life. How she worshipped her father and always hoped to please her mother. How she trusted me but was afraid when I made faces at her that were too expressive, and defied what she'd learned from the adult-driven world order that denies animals the process of thought. I crawled to her on my elbows and placed my nose next to her thigh, tanned from the summer sun. Then I raised my eyebrows slightly, as if to ask if she could ever forgive me for not protecting her animals. She waited a long time to give me her answer, but she finally gave it. She placed her hand on my head and let it rest there. She didn't scratch me. It would be a while before she allowed herself to do that. But she did touch me, which meant she forgave me for what had happened, though the wound was still too raw and the pain was still too great for her to forget. Later, after everyone had eaten and Zoe was put to bed in her room that had been cleaned of the carnage, I found Denny sitting on the porch steps with a drink of hard liquor, which I thought was strange because he hardly ever drank hard liquor. I approached cautiously and he noticed. "It's okay, boy," he said. He patted the step next to him, and I went to him. I sniffed his wrist and took a tentative lick. He smiled and rubbed my neck. "I'm really sorry," he said. "I lost my mind." The patch of lawn behind our house was not big, but it was nice in the evening. It was rimmed by a dirt strip covered with sweet-smelling cedar chips where they planted flowers in the spring, and they had a bush in the corner that made flowers that attracted the bees and made me nervous whenever Zoe played near it. But she never got stung. Denny finished his drink with a long swallow and shivered involuntarily. He produced a bottle from nowhere. I was surprised I hadn't noticed it, and poured himself another. He stood up and took a couple of steps and stretched to the sky. "We got first place, Enzo. Not in class. We took first place overall. You know what that means?" My heart jumped. I knew what it meant. It meant that he was the champion. It meant he was the best. "It means a seat in a touring car next season. That's what it means," Denny said to me. "I got an offer from a real live racing team. Do you know what an offer is?" I loved it when he talked to me like that, dragging out the drama, ratcheting up the anticipation. I've always found great pleasure in the narrative tease, but then I'm a dramatist. For me, a good story is all about setting up expectations and delivering on them in an exciting and surprising way. Getting an offer means I can drive if I come up with my share of sponsorship money for the season, which is reasonable and almost attainable. And if I'm willing to spend the better part of 6 months away from Eve and Zoe and you, am I willing to do that? I didn't say anything because I was torn. I knew I was Denny's biggest fan and most steadfast supporter in his racing, but I also felt something like what Eve and Zoe must have felt whenever he went away, a hollow pit in my stomach at the idea of his absence. He must have been able to read my mind because he gulped at his glass and said, "I don't think so either," which was what I was thinking. "I can't believe she left you like that," he said. "I know she had a virus, but still." Did he really believe that, or was he lying to himself? Or maybe he just believed it because Eve wanted him to believe it. No matter. Had I been a person, I could have told him the truth about Eve's condition. "It was a bad virus," he said, more to himself than to me, "and she couldn't think." And suddenly, I was unsure. Had I been a person, had I been able to tell him the truth, I'm not sure he would have wanted to hear it. He groaned and sat back down and filled his glass again. "I'm taking those stuffed animals out of your allowance," he said with a chuckle. He looked at me, then took my chin with his hand. "I love you, boy," he said, "and I promise I'll never do that again, no matter what. I'm really sorry." He was blathering. He was drunk. But it made me feel so much love for him, too. "You're tough," he said. "You can do 3 days like that because you're one tough dog." I felt proud. "I know you'd never do anything deliberately to hurt Zoe," he said. I laid my head on his leg and looked up at him. "Sometimes I think you actually understand me," he said. "It's like there's a person inside there. Like you know everything." "I do," I said to myself. "I do." 12. Eve's condition was elusive and unpredictable. One day she would suffer a headache of crushing magnitude, another day debilitating nausea,
A third would open with dizziness and end with a dark and angry mood. And these days were never linked together consecutively. Between them would be days or even weeks of relief, life as usual. And then Denny would get a call at work, and he would run to Eve's assistance, drive her home from her job, impose on a friend to follow in her car, and spend the rest of the day watching helplessly. The intense and arbitrary nature of Eve's affliction was far beyond Denny's grasp. The wailings, the dramatic screaming fits, the falling on the floor in fits of anguish. These are things that only dogs and women understand, because we tap into the pain directly. We connect to pain directly from its source. And so it is at once brilliant and brutal and clear. Like white-hot metal spraying out of a fire hose, we can appreciate the aesthetic while taking the worst of it straight in the face. Men, on the other hand, are all filters and deflectors and timed release. For men, it's like athlete's foot. Spray the special spray on it, they say, and it goes away. They have no idea that the manifestation of their affliction, the fungus between their hairy toes, is merely a symptom, an indication of a systemic problem. A candida bloom in their bowels, for instance, or some other upset to their system. Suppressing the symptom does nothing but force the true problem to express itself on a deeper level at some other time. "Go see a doctor," he said to her. "Get some medication." And she howled to the moon in reply. He never understood, as I did, what she meant when she said that medication would only mask the pain, not make it go away. And what's the point of that? He never understood when she said that if she went to a doctor, the doctor would only invent a disease that would explain why he couldn't help her. And there was so much time between episodes. There was so much hope. Denny was frustrated by his impotence, and in that regard, I could understand his point of view. It's frustrating for me to be unable to speak, to feel that I have so much to say, so many ways I can help, but I'm locked in a soundproof box, a game show isolation booth from which I can see out, and I can hear what's going on, but they never turn on my microphone, and they never let me out. It might drive a person mad. It certainly has driven many a dog mad. The good dog that would never hurt a soul, but is found one day having eaten the face of his master as she slept deeply under the influence of sleeping pills? There was nothing wrong with that dog except that his mind finally snapped. As awful as it sounds, it happens. It's on the TV news regularly. Myself, I have found ways around the madness. I work at my human gait, for instance. I practice chewing my food slowly, like people do. I study the television for clues on behavior and to learn how to react in certain situations. In my next life, when I am born again as a person, I will practically be an adult the moment I am plucked from the womb, with all the preparation I have done. It will be all I can do to wait for my new human body to mature to adulthood so I may excel at all the athletic and intellectual pursuits I hope to enjoy. Denny avoided the madness of his personal sound booth hell by driving through it. There was nothing he could do to make Eve's distress go away, and once he realized that, he made a commitment to do everything else better. Often, things happen to race cars in the heat of the race. A square-toothed gear in a transmission may break, suddenly leaving the driver without all of his gears. Or perhaps a clutch fails. Brakes go soft from overheating. Suspensions break. When faced with one of these problems, the poor driver crashes. The average driver gives up. The great drivers drive through the problem. They figure out a way to continue racing. Like in the Luxembourg Grand Prix in 1989, when the Irish racer Kevin Finnerty York finished the race victoriously and later revealed that he had driven the final 20 laps of the race with only two gears. To be able to possess a machine in such a way is the ultimate show of determination and awareness. It makes one realize that the physicality of our world is a boundary to us only if our will is weak. A true champion can accomplish things that a normal person would think impossible. Denny cut back his hours at work so he could take Zoe to her preschool. In the evenings after dinner, he read to her and helped her learn her numbers and letters. He took over all the grocery shopping and cooking. He took over the cleaning of the house. And he did it all excellently and without complaint. He wanted to relieve Eve of any burden, any job that could cause stress. What he couldn't do, though, with all of the extra he was doing,
was continue to engage her in the same playful and physically affectionate way I had grown used to seeing. It was impossible for him to do everything, clearly. He had decided that the care of her organism would receive the topmost priority, which I believe was the correct thing for him to do under the circumstances, because he had me. I see green as gray. I see red as black. Does that make me a bad potential person? If you taught me to read and provided for me the same computer system as someone has provided for Stephen Hawking, I, too, would write great books. And yet, you don't teach me to read. And you don't give me a computer stick I can push around with my nose to point at the next letter I wish typed. So whose fault is it that I am what I am? Denny did not stop loving Eve. He merely delegated his love-giving to me. I became the provider of love and comfort by proxy. When she ailed, and he took charge of Zoe and whisked her out of the house to see one of the many wonderful animated films that they make for children so that she might not hear the cries of agony from her mother, I stayed behind. He trusted me. He would tell me, as he and Zoe packed their bottles of water and their special sandwich cookies without hydrogenated oils that he bought for her at the good market, he would say, "Go take care of her for me, Enzo, please." And I did. I took care of her by curling up at her bedside, or if she had collapsed on the floor, by curling up next to her there. Often she would hold me close to her, hold me tight to her body, and when she did, she would tell me things about the pain. "I cannot lie still. I cannot be alone with this. I need to scream and thrash because it stays away when I scream. When I'm silent, it finds me. It tracks me down and pierces me and says, 'Now I've got you. Now you belong to me.'" Demon, gremlin, poltergeist, ghost, phantom, spirit, shadow, ghoul, devil. People are afraid of them, so they relegate their existence to stories, volumes of books that can be closed and put on the shelf or left behind at a bed and breakfast. They clench their eyes shut so they will see no evil. But trust me when I tell you that the zebra is real. Somewhere, the zebra is dancing. The spring finally ground around to us through an exceptionally wet winter, full of gray days and rain and an edgy cold I rarely found rejuvenating. Over the winter, Eve ate poorly and became drawn and pale. When her pain came, she often went for days without eating a bite of food. She never exercised, so her thinness had no tone, slack skin over brittle bones. She was wasting away. Denny was concerned, but Eve never heeded his pleas for her to consult a doctor. "A mild case of depression," she would say. "They'll try to give her pills, and she doesn't want pills." Then one evening after dinner, which was a special one, though I don't remember if it was a birthday or an anniversary, Denny suddenly appeared naked in the bedroom, and Eve was naked on the bed. It seemed so odd to me, because they hadn't mounted or even played with each other in such a long time, but there they were. He positioned himself over her, and she said to him, "The field is fertile." "You aren't really, are you?" he asked. "Just say it," she replied after a moment, her eyes having dimmed, having been sucked deep into their sockets and swallowed by the puffy skin, suggesting anything but fertility. "I embrace the fertility," he said. But their exchange seemed weak and unenthusiastic. She made noise, but she was pretending. I could tell, because in the middle of it she looked at me and shook her head and waved me off. Respectfully, I withdrew to another room and drifted into a light sleep. And, if I recall correctly, I dreamed of the crows. 13. They sit in the trees and on the electric wires and on the roofs, and they watch everything, the sinister little bastards. They cackle with a dark edge, like they're mocking you, cawing constantly. They know where you are when you're in the house. They know where you are when you're outside. They're always waiting. The smaller cousin of the raven, they are resentful and angry, bitter at being genetically dwarfed by their brothers. The raven, it is said, is the next step up the evolutionary ladder from man. The raven created man, after all, according to the legends of the Northwest Coast natives. It's interesting to note here that the deity that corresponds with the raven in Plains Indian folklore is the coyote, which is a dog. So it seems to me, we are all smashed together at the top of the spiritual food chain. So if the raven created man, and the crow is the raven's cousin, where does the crow fit in? The crow fits in the garbage. Very smart, very sly. They are best when they apply their evil little genius to uncapping a garbage can or pecking through some kind of enclosure to get its scrap food. They are scum, creatures of cluster. They call them a murder when they are in a group. A good word, because when they are together, you want to kill them. I never chase a crow. They hop away, taunting, trying to dupe you into a chase in which you will become injured, trying to get you stuck somewhere far away so they can have their way with the garbage. It's true. Sometimes, when I have nightmares, I dream of crows, a murder of them, attacking me ruthlessly, cruelly tearing me to shreds. It is the worst. When we first moved to our house, something happened with the crows, and that's why I know they hate me. It's bad to have enemies. Denny always picked up my leavings in small green biodegradable bags. It's part of what people do as a penance for their need to keep dogs under such strict supervision. They must extract our excrement from between the grass blades with a plastic bag that has been turned inside out. They must grab it with their fingers and handle it. Even though there's a plastic barrier, they never enjoy the task because they can smell it, and their sense of smell lacks the sophistication to discern the subtlety of the layers of scent and their meaning. Denny collected the small crap-filled bags and kept them in a plastic grocery bag. Occasionally he would dispose of the larger bag in a garbage can in the park up the street. I guess he didn't want to pollute his own garbage can with bags of my feces. I don't know. The crows, who pride themselves on being cousins of the raven and therefore being very smart, love going after a bag of groceries. And they have, on many occasions, gone after a bag on the porch left outside when Denny or Eve brought home more than a few at a time. They can get in and out so fast, maybe find some cookies or something and fly away. On one occasion, when I was young, the crows spotted Eve bringing home the groceries, and they crowded nearby, clustering in a tree just on the edge of the property, so many of them. They were silent, not wanting to draw attention to themselves, but I knew they were there. Eve had parked in the alley, and she made several trips with bags from the car to the porch, then from the porch into the house. The crows watched, and they noticed that Eve had left a bag behind. Well, they are smart. I have to give them credit, for they didn't move in right away. They watched and waited until Eve went upstairs and undressed and got into the bathtub, as she sometimes did in the afternoon when she had a day off from work. They watched and were sure that the glass-paned kitchen door was closed and locked so thieves and rapists couldn't get in, and so I couldn't get out. Then they made their move. They swooped in, several of them, and picked up the bag with their beaks. One of them goaded me by walking up to the glass and trying to get me to bark. Normally I would have resisted the urge just to spite them, but knowing what I knew, I barked a few times, enough to make it convincing. They didn't go far. They wanted to taunt me with it. They wanted me to watch them enjoy the treats in the bag. So they stopped inside the yard, on the grass, the whole group of them. They danced around in circles and made faces at me and flapped their wings and called for their friends. They tore open the plastic and they dove in with all of their beaks to eat the wonderful food and delicious items that were hidden inside. And they ate. They gulped, those stupid birds. They ate from the bag and they swallowed with glee and they choked on giant mouthfuls of my shit. My shit! Oh, the looks on their faces, the stunned silence, the indignation, the shaking of heads, and then they flew off en masse to the neighbor up the street with the dribbling fountain so they could wash their beaks. They came back then, clean and mad, hundreds of them, maybe thousands. They stood on the back porch and on the back lawn, so thick with crows it was like a massive, undulating layer of tar and feathers, all of their beady eyes trained on me, staring at me, as if to say, "Come out, little doggy, and we'll peck your eyeballs out." I didn't go out, and they soon left. But when Denny got home from work that day, he looked in the back. Eve was cooking dinner, and Zoe was still little, in a high chair. Denny looked outside and said, "Why is there so much bird crap on the deck?" I knew. Given a Stephen Hawking computer, I could have made a good joke of it. He went out and turned on the hose and washed the deck, and he collected the torn poop bags with puzzlement, but no inquiry. The trees and telephone wires and electrical wires were heavy with those birds, all of them watching. I didn't go out with him. And when he wanted to go throw the ball, I pretended I was sick and climbed onto my bed and slept. It was a good laugh watching those dumb birds who think they're so smart with their beaks full of dog shit. But, as with all things, there were repercussions. Since that time, my nightmares have always contained angry crows. A murder of them. 14. The clues were all there. I simply hadn't read them correctly. Over the winter, he had played a video racing game obsessively, which wasn't like him. He had never gotten into racing games, but that winter, he played the game every night after Eve went to bed. And he raced on American circuits only, St. Petersburg and Laguna Seca, Road Atlanta and Mid-Ohio. I should have known just from seeing the tracks he was racing. He wasn't playing a video game. He was studying the circuits. He was learning turn-in points and braking points. I'd heard him talk about how accurate the backgrounds are on these video games, how drivers have found the games can be quite helpful for getting acquainted with new circuits, but I never thought. And his diet. No alcohol, no sugar, no fried foods. His exercise regimen, running several days a week, swimming at the Medgar Evers pool, lifting weights in the garage of the big guy down the street who started lifting when he was in prison. Denny had been preparing himself. He was lean and strong and ready to do battle in a race car, and I had missed all the signs. But then, I believe I had been duped. Because when he came downstairs with his track bag packed that day in March and his suitcase on wheels and his special helmet and Hans device bag, Eve and Zoe seemed to know all about his leaving. He had told them. He hadn't told me. The parting was strange. Zoe was both excited and nervous. Eve was somber, and I was utterly confused. Where was he going? I raised my eyebrows, lifted my ears, and cocked my head. I used every facial gesture at my disposal in an attempt to glean information. "Sebring," he said to me, reading my mind the way he does sometimes. "I took the seat in the touring car. Didn't I tell you?" The touring car? But that was something he said he could never do. We agreed on that. I was at once elated and devastated. A race weekend is at least 3 nights away, sometimes 4 when the event is on the opposite coast, and there are 11 races over an 8-month period. He would be away so much of the time. I was worried about the emotional well-being of those of us left behind. But I am a racer at heart, and a racer will never let something that has already happened affect what is happening now. The news that he had taken the touring car seat and was flying to Sebring to race on ESPN2 was extremely good. He was finally doing what he should be doing when he was supposed to do it. He wasn't waiting or worrying about everyone else. He was looking out for himself. A race car driver must be very selfish. It is a cold truth. Even his family must come second to the race. I wagged my tail enthusiastically, and he smiled at me with a twinkle in his eye. He knew that I understood everything he said. "Be good now," he chided me playfully. "Watch over the girls." He hugged little Zoe and kissed Eve gently. But as he turned away from her, she launched herself into his chest and grabbed him tight. She buried herself in his shoulder, her face red with congested tears. "Please come back," she said, her words muffled by his mass. "Of course I will. Please come back," she repeated. He soothed her. "I promise I'll come back in one piece," he said. She shook her head, which was still pressed against his body. "I don't care how many pieces," she said. "Just promise you'll come back." He quickly glanced at me, as if I could clarify what she was really asking. Did she mean come back alive? Or come back and not leave her? Or something else entirely? He didn't know. I, however, knew exactly what she meant. Eve wasn't worried about Denny not returning. She was worried about herself. She knew that something was wrong with her, though she didn't know what, and she was afraid it would return in some terrible way when Denny was not with us. I was concerned as well, the memory of the zebra still in my head. I couldn't explain this to Denny, but I could resolve to remain steadfast in his absence.
"I promise," he said, hopefully.
After he had gone, Eve closed her eyes and took a deep breath. When she opened her eyes again, she looked at me, and I could see that she had resolved something for herself as well.
"I insisted he do it," she said to me.
"I think it will be good for me. It will make me stronger." That was the first race of the series, and the race didn't go well for Denny, though it went fine for Eve, Zoe, and me. We watched it on TV, and Denny qualified in the top third of the field. But shortly into the race, he had to pit because of a cut tire. A crew member had trouble mounting the new wheel, and by the time Denny returned to the race, he was a lap down and never recovered. 24th place. The second race came only a few weeks after the first, and again, Eve, Zoe, and I managed fine. For Denny, the results of the race were very much the same as the first. Spilled fuel that resulted in a stop-and-go penalty, costing Denny a lap. 30th place. Denny was extremely frustrated.
"I like the guys," he told us at dinner when he was home for a stretch. "They're good people, but they're not a good pit crew. They're making mistakes, killing our season. If they would just give me a chance to finish, I'd finish well."
"Can't you get a new crew?" Eve asked. I was in the kitchen, next to the dining room. I never stayed in the dining room when they ate, out of respect. No one likes a dog under the table looking for crumbs when they're eating. So I couldn't see them, but I could hear them. Denny picking up the wooden salad bowl and serving himself more salad. Zoe pushing her chicken nuggets around on the plate.
"Eat them, honey," Eve said. "Don't play with them."
"It's not the quality of the man," Denny tried to explain. "It's the quality of the team."
"How do you fix it?" Eve asked. "You're spending so much time away, it seems like a waste. What's the point of racing if you can't finish? Zoe, you've only had 2 bites. Eat."
The crunching of romaine. Zoe drinking from her sippy cup.
"Practice," Denny said. "Practice, practice, practice."
"When will you practice?" "They want me to go down to Infineon next week, work with the Apex Porsche people, work hard with the pit crew so there are no more mistakes. The sponsors are getting frustrated." Eve fell silent.
"Next week is your week off," she said finally.
"I won't be gone long. 3 or 4 days. Good salad. Did you make the dressing yourself?" I couldn't read their body language because I couldn't see them, but there are some things a dog can sense. Tension, fear, anxiety. These states of being are the result of a chemical release inside the human body. They are totally physiological, in other words, involuntary. People like to think they have evolved beyond instinct, but in fact, they still have fight-or-flight responses to stimuli. And when their bodies respond, I can smell the chemical release from their pituitary glands. For instance, adrenaline has a very specific odor, which is not so much smelled, but tasted. I know a person can't understand that concept, but that's the best way to describe it. The taste of an alkaline on the back of my tongue. From my position on the kitchen floor, I could taste Eve's adrenaline. Clearly she had steeled herself for Denny's racing absences. She was not prepared for his impromptu practices in Sonoma, and she was angry and afraid. I heard chair legs scrape as a chair was pushed back. I heard plates being stacked, flatware nervously gathered.
"Eat your nuggets," Eve said again, this time sternly.
"I'm full," Zoe declared.
"You haven't eaten anything. How can you be full?"
"I don't like nuggets."
"You're not leaving the table until you eat your nuggets."
"I don't like nuggets," Zoe shrieked, and suddenly the world was a very dark place. Anxiety, anticipation, excitement, antipathy. All these emotions have a distinctive smell, many of which were exuding from the dining room at that moment. After a long silence, Denny said, "I'll make you a hot dog."
"No," Eve said. "She'll eat the nuggets. She likes nuggets. She's just being difficult. Eat."
Another pause, and then the sound of a child gagging. Denny almost laughed.
"I'll make her a hot dog," he said again. "She's going to eat the goddamn nuggets," Eve shouted.
"She doesn't like the nuggets. I'll make her a hot dog," Denny replied firmly.
"No, you won't. She likes the nuggets. She's just doing this because you're here. I'm not making a new dinner every time she decides she doesn't like something. She asked for the fucking nuggets. Now she'll eat the fucking nuggets."
Fury has a very distinctive smell, too. Zoe started to cry. I went to the door and looked in. Eve was standing at the head of the table, her face red and pinched. Zoe was sobbing into her nuggets. Denny stood to make himself seem bigger. It's important for the alpha to be bigger. Often, just posturing can get a member of the pack to back down. "You're overreacting," he said. "Why don't you go lie down and let me finish up here?"
"You always take her side," Eve barked.
"I just want her to have a dinner she'll eat."
"Fine," Eve hissed. "I'll make her a hot dog then."
Eve whirled from the table and almost crushed me when she burst into the kitchen. She threw open the freezer door and snatched a package of hot dogs, turned on the faucet, and held the package under the running water. She grabbed a knife from the block and stabbed into the package, and that's when the evening turned from one filled with forgettable arguments to one marked by undeniable and permanent evidence. As if the knife had a will of its own and wanted to get involved in the fracas, the blade leapt from the wet, frozen package and sliced deep and clean into the fleshy webbing of Eve's left palm between her thumb and fingers. The knife clattered in the sink, and Eve grabbed her hand with a wail. Watery drops of blood speckled the backsplash. Denny was there in a moment with a dishcloth.
"Let me see it," he said, peeling the blood-soaked cloth from her hand, which she held by the wrist as if it were no longer a part of her body, but some alien creature that had attacked her.
"We should take you to the hospital," he said.
"No," she bellowed. "No hospital."
"You need stitches," he said, examining the gushing wound. She didn't answer immediately, but her eyes were filled with tears. Not from pain, but from fear. She was so afraid of doctors and hospitals. She was afraid that she might go in, and they would never let her out.
"Please," she whispered to Denny. "Please, no hospital."
He groaned and shook his head.
"I'll see if I can close it," he said.
Zoe stood next to me, silent, eyes wide, holding a chicken nugget, watching. Neither of us knew what to do.
"Zoe, baby," Denny said, "can you find the butterfly closures for me in the hall closet? We'll get Mommy all patched up, okay?"
Zoe didn't move. How could she? She knew she was the cause of Mommy's pain. It was her blood that Eve was bleeding.
"Zoe, please," Denny said, lifting Eve to her feet. "Blue and white box, red letters. Look for the B word, butterfly."
Zoe headed off to find the box. Denny guided Eve to the bathroom and closed the door. I heard Eve cry out in pain. When Zoe returned with the box of bandages, she didn't know where her parents had gone, so I walked her to the bathroom door and barked. Denny opened the door a crack and took the bandages.
"Thanks, Zoe. I'll take care of Mommy now. You can go play or watch TV."
He closed the door. Zoe looked at me for a moment with concern in her eyes, and I wanted to help her. I walked toward the living room and looked back. She still hesitated, so I went to get her. I nudged her and tried again. This time she followed me. I sat before the television and waited for her to turn it on, which she did. And we watched Kids Next Door. And then Denny and Eve appeared. They saw us watching TV together, and they seemed somehow relieved. They sat next to Zoe and watched along with us, not saying a word. When the show was over, Eve pressed the mute button on the remote.
"The cut isn't very bad," she said to Zoe. "If you're still hungry, I can make you a hot dog."
Zoe shook her head. And then Eve started sobbing. Sitting on the couch, exposed to the world, she collapsed into herself. I could see her energy implode.
"I'm so sorry," she cried.
Denny put his arm around her shoulder and held her.
"I don't want to be like this," she sobbed. "It's not me. I'm so sorry. I don't want to be mean. It's not who I am."
"Beware," I thought. "The zebra hides everywhere." Zoe grabbed her mother and held tight, which unleashed a flood of tears from both of them, and they were joined by Denny, who hovered over them like a firefighting helicopter, dumping his bucket of tears on the fire. I left. Not because I felt they wanted their privacy, believe me. I left because I felt that they had resolved their issues and all was good in the world. And also, I was hungry. I wandered into the dining room and scanned the floor for droppings. There wasn't much. But in the kitchen, I found something good. A nugget. Zoe must have dropped it after Eve cut herself. It looked like a fair snack to me, something to tide me over until they got over their cuddly moment and remembered to feed me. I sniffed the nugget, and I recoiled in disgust. It was bad. I sniffed again. Rancid. Foul. Disease-laden. The nuggets had been in the freezer too long, or out of the freezer too long, or both, I concluded, having witnessed what little regard people pay to their grocery sacks. This nugget, and probably all the others on the plate, had definitely turned. I felt bad for Zoe. All she'd had to do was say that the nuggets didn't taste right, and this incident would have been avoided. But Eve would have found a way to hurt herself anyway, I suppose. They needed this. This moment. It was important to them as a family, and I understood that. In racing, they say that your car goes where your eyes go. The driver who cannot tear his eyes away from the wall as he spins out of control will meet that wall. The driver who looks down the track as he feels his tires break free will regain control of his vehicle. Your car goes where your eyes go. Simply another way of saying that which you manifest is before you. I know it's true. Racing doesn't lie. 15. When Denny went away the following week, we went to Eve's parents' house so they could take care of us. Eve's hand was bandaged up, which indicated to me that the cut was worse than she had let on, but it didn't slow her down much. Maxwell and Trish, the twins, lived in a very fancy house on a large parcel of wooded land on Mercer Island, with an amazing view of Lake Washington and Seattle. And for having such a beautiful place to live, they were among the most unhappy people I've ever met. Nothing was good enough for them. They were always complaining about how things could be better or why things were as bad as they were. When we arrived, they started in about Denny right away. He doesn't spend enough time with Zoe. He's neglecting your relationship. His dog needs a bath, like my hygiene had anything to do with it. What are you going to do? Maxwell asked her. They were standing around in the kitchen while Trish cooked dinner, making something that Zoe would inevitably hate. It was a warm spring evening, so the twins were wearing polo shirts with their slacks. Maxwell and Trish were drinking Manhattans with cherries, Eve a glass of wine. She had rejected the painkiller offered to her, which was left over from the hernia operation Maxwell had undergone a few months before. "I'm going to get in shape," Eve said. "I feel fat." "But you're so thin," Trish said. "You can feel fat even if you're thin. I feel out of shape." "Oh." "I mean about Denny," Maxwell said.
"What do I need to do about Denny?" Eve asked.
"Something! What is he contributing to your family? You make all the money!"
"He's my husband and he's Zoe's father and I love him. What else does he need to contribute to our family?"
Maxwell snorted and slapped the counter. I flinched.
"You're scaring the dog," Trish pointed out.
She rarely called me by name. They do that in prisoner of war camps, I've heard. Depersonalization. "I'm just frustrated," Maxwell said. "I want the best for my girls. Whenever you come to stay here, it's because he's gone racing. It's not good for you."
"This season is really important for his career," Eve said, trying to remain steadfast. "I wish I were able to be more involved, but I'm doing the best I can, and he appreciates that. What I don't need is you going after me for it."
"I'm sorry," Maxwell said, holding up his hands in surrender. "I'm sorry. I just want what's best for you."
"I know, Daddy," Eve said, and she leaned forward and kissed his cheek. "I want what's best for me, too."
She took her wine outside into the backyard, and I lingered. Maxwell opened the refrigerator and retrieved a jar of the hot peppers he liked to eat. He was always eating peppers. He opened the jar and squeezed his fingers inside, extracted a long pepperoncini, and crunched into it.
"Do you see how frail she's gotten?" Trish asked. "Like a whippet. But she feels fat."
He shook his head. "My daughter, with a mechanic. No, not a mechanic. A customer service technician. Where did we go wrong?"
"She's always made her own choices," Trish said.
"But at least her choices made sense. She majored in art history, for Christ's sake. She ends up with him?"
"The dog is watching you," Trish said after a moment. "Maybe he wants a pepper."
Maxwell's expression changed. "Want a treat, boy?" he asked, holding out a pepperoncini. That wasn't why I had been watching him. I was watching him to better glean the meaning of his words. Still, I was hungry, so I sniffed at the pepper.
"They're good," he prompted. "Imported from Italy."
I took the pepper from him and immediately felt a prickly sensation on my tongue. I bit down, and a burning liquid filled my mouth. I quickly swallowed and thought I was done with the discomfort. Surely the acid in my stomach would cancel out the acid of the pepper. But that's when the pain really began. My throat felt as if it had been scraped raw. My stomach churned. I immediately left the room and the house. Outside the back door, I lapped at my bowl of water, but it did little to help. I made my way to a nearby shrub and lay down in its shade and rested until the burning went away. When they took me out that night, Trish and Maxwell did, as Zoe and Eve had long been asleep. They stood at the back porch and repeated their silly mantra.
"Get busy, boy, get busy."
Still feeling somewhat queasy, I ventured away from the house farther than I usually did, crouched in my stance and shat. After I did my business, I saw that my stool was loose and watery, and when I sniffed at it, it was unusually foul-smelling. I knew I was safe, and the ordeal had passed. Still, since that time, I have been wary of trying new foods that might upset my system, and I have never accepted food from someone I didn't fully trust. 16. The weeks tripped by with tremendous haste, as if digging into the fall were the most important mission of all. There was no lingering on accomplishment. Denny got his first victory in Laguna in early June. He pegged a podium finish, third place, at Road Atlanta, and he finished eighth in Denver. That week with the boys in Sonoma had worked out the kinks with the crew, and it was all on Denny's shoulders, and his shoulders were broad. That summer, when we gathered around the dinner table, there was something to talk about. Trophies, photographs, replays on television late at night. Suddenly, people were hanging around, coming over for dinner. Not just Mike from work, where they were happy to accommodate Denny's crazy schedule, but others, too. NASCAR veteran Derek Cope. Motorsports Hall of Famer Chip Hanauer. We were even introduced to Luca Pantoni, a very powerful man at Ferrari headquarters in Maranello, Italy, who was in Seattle visiting Don Kitch Jr., Seattle's premier racing tutor. I never broke my rule about the dining room. I have too much integrity for that. But I sat upon the threshold, I assure you. My toenails edged over the line so that I could be that much closer to greatness. I learned more about racing in those few weeks than I had in all my prior years of watching video and television. To hear the estimable Ross Bentley, coach of champions, speak about breathing, was absolutely stunning. Zoe chattered away constantly, always something to say, always something to show. She would sit on Denny's knee with her big eyes absorbing every word of the conversation, and at an appropriate moment, she would declare some racing truth Denny had taught her. "Slow hands in the fast stuff, fast hands in the slow stuff," or something like that, and all the big men would be suitably impressed. I was proud of her in those moments. Since I was unable to impress the racing men with my own knowledge, the next best thing was to experience it vicariously through Zoe. Eve was happy again. She took what she called mat classes and gained muscle tone, and often alerted Denny to the needs of her fertile field, sometimes with great urgency. Her health had greatly improved, with no explanation. No more headaches, no more nausea. She continued to have trouble with her injured hand, oddly, and sometimes she used a wrist support to help her grip when cooking. Still, from what I heard in the bedroom late at night, her hands retained all of the necessary flexibility and suppleness to make Denny and herself very happy. Yet, for every peak, there is a valley. Denny's next race was pivotal, as a good finish would solidify his position as Rookie of the Year. In that race, at Phoenix International Raceway, Denny got tagged in the first turn. This is a rule of racing. No race has ever been won in the first corner. Many have been lost there. He got caught in a bad spot. Someone tried to late brake him going into the corner and locked it up. Tires don't work if they aren't rolling. In full-out skid, the hard charger slammed into Denny's left front wheel, destroying the car's alignment. The toe was skewed so badly that his car crabbed up the track, scrubbing seconds off his lap time. Alignment, late braking, locking up, toe in, mere jargon. These are simply the terms we use to explain the phenomena around us. What matters is not how precisely we can explain the event, but the event itself and its consequence, which was that Denny's car was broken. He finished the race, but he finished DFL. That's what he called it when he told me about it. A new category. There's DNS, did not start, there's DNF, did not finish, and there's DNF.